What I would say is effective businesses and effective schools will always have a leader who tries to build commitment to something greater.
Hi, I'm Shiv Khera, and you're listening to The Ed Show. Welcome to The Ed Show, a podcast where I sit with some amazing personalities from across sectors and borders to have meaningful conversation on topics that matter to us. Welcome back. My guest for the day is someone who strongly advocates the need of changing our classrooms. He is a catalyst of change, a person who is serving in school education space for more than two decades. He is a blogger, a keynote speaker, and a mind-blowing author. One of his latest books, The 10-Minute Principle, is a must-read for educators in order to understand and develop leadership skills. He is currently serving as the principal of John Williams Middle School, Virginia, and is a recipient of the Horace Mann Educator of the Year Award. He is Evan Robb. Hi, Evan. Welcome on the show.
Thank you very much. I'm really excited to be here today. Honored that you've asked me to be a guest on your podcast and look forward to a conversation.
Evan, you are one person I know who strongly advocates to change the classrooms as per the change in times. Can you elaborate on how we should be changing our classrooms?
Yeah, that's a really good question. You know, I'll speak from my experience, and hopefully this will resonate with people that are hearing this in other parts of the world. As you know, but I'll inform your viewers, I live in Virginia, USA, about 50 miles away from Washington, D.C. Most people know about Washington, D.C. And my experience in education was what I would call a very traditional experience. I sat in classrooms that were in rows when I was a student. I took notes, I listened to lectures, and took tests. It probably typically every Friday, and some kids would do well in the class and some kids would not, but yet the class would still continue to carry on. And I think that that model, which is the very traditional education model, is something that we can do better. And so I think it's important to evaluate the needs to change the way that we work with our kids, focus on skills that they need for college and their careers as they move through life, and also focus on meeting the needs of kids through differentiating, through providing better avenues for access, and creating equity. Also, changing the dynamic of a classroom. You know, I believe that very few things that we prepare children for in the real world mimic the type of classroom that I described, of everyone sitting silently in rows, listening, and then taking tests. So, you know, I'm much more interested in personalization, as I said, differentiation, and also creating collaborative engagement opportunities for students to learn and also to engage in inquiry versus just simply receiving information.
Evan, I need to understand this thing from you. You know, since the beginning of this year, the entire education delivery mechanism has changed. So how should we as educators change our teaching and our leadership style to cope up with this fast-changing scenario?
Well, there's some fundamental changes, you know, that occur. And again, in where I am, my school is starting the school year virtually. So we do not have any students in the building. So we are instructing in a very, very different way. And that is challenging. And so in many ways, I find myself, you know, this is, I feel like a new administrator, because I am needing to lead in a way that I have not led before. You know, typically, people that are principals spend a lot of time visiting classrooms, observing teachers, seeing kids, you know, being very actively involved in what's going on in the school. And now that, of course, is all occurring virtually. So that poses different challenges. But what I always like to tell people that I work with and people that I speak with is there are a couple different ways that we can face challenges. One is with pessimism, but the other is with a little more optimistic mindset, a willingness to try some things new. Now, one of the things that I can share that I think is really important is that when educators need to do things different, we have to take a really good look at the culture of our organizations, because if the culture is inhibitive of people trying new things, taking risks and chances, then it becomes much more challenging for teachers to actually try those new things and take chances. So I need to make sure, and I encourage other educational leaders to make sure, that they are creating environments where people feel supported, where they have the professional development they need to try things new, and where they, and a culture that allows them to do that without fear of reprisal or getting in trouble if they try something that doesn't work well for them. So what I want to kind of capture this for you is there are cultural shifts that we always need to take a look at. What I talked about, the, you know, creating an environment where risk-taking is supported, where people feel trusted, that is true everywhere. But this is an opportunity to really look back on some of those elements and make sure that they are in place so we can move forward in the most effective way for kids. Because again, we're asking people to do things much different than what they've done before. And to some degree, the type of instruction that occurs virtually cannot mimic a regular classroom. But we need to find ways to make it engaging for kids, and we need to find ways still to create differentiated opportunities. But I would say part of the problem in America, and this may be true in other places that are engaged in virtual learning, is the equity and access piece. Many communities do not have a level of Wi-Fi that allows all students to be able to be engaged in virtual learning. And that poses different challenges for teachers and also challenges for leaders on how to provide asynchronous learning opportunities to students who cannot engage synchronously within a virtual environment.
You know, I completely agree with you. And, as teachers, we should nurture positive culture in our classrooms. But it's not always possible to create a positive culture that can allow teachers to leave a long-lasting impact in the student's life, as somehow I believe creating culture requires leadership. How do you feel that our educators and administrators can create positive cultures in their classrooms or schools?
Very good question. I guess, you know, the first thing I'd like to say, and this is something that I certainly share with educators, is, you know, we are, you know, certainly in the United States of America, we are in the middle of a very big pandemic. We have a lot of people that are sick. We have many people that have died. And that is tragic, and it is incredibly sad. It is hard for people to be positive when things are very, very challenging. But what I always encourage people is, you know, even though I understand that you can't always be positive, especially when things are really hard, but you can't be optimistic, you know, optimistic of a better future. And you can have hope that around the corner is something better. Now, in terms of a classroom and creating an environment where positivity is encouraged, where optimism is encouraged, where hope is encouraged, the first thing that I would share is there needs to be real parallelism between what the leader models and encourages through their actions and words, and that can transfer into a classroom. So let me break that down a little bit. If the leader of the school talks a lot about being positive, but their actions are contradictory, no one's going to believe the leader. Teachers need to make sure that they see congruency between the words and the actions of the leader, and that will encourage them and empower them to bring those elements into their classroom. One of the things that I can say with kids, you know, I know that you obviously have a big education background, is kids typically are not motivated by failure. Doing poorly and or feeling negative about themselves is not a motivator to make kids feel better about their learning. But I would say from the educational leader standpoint, it is certainly not the way to get the best out of people in your building, to allow them to feel negative or to allow them to feel punished if they or where they actually are punished if they do things that may have an error, because sometimes when you take chances, that's going to occur. So I think, again, I'm going to pull it all back to culture, pull a lot of it back to the tonality that the leader sets, and say that that is a can be a catalyst to encourage positivity within classrooms, and then in turn have a positive impact on the children that are in the classrooms.
Well, it certainly creates positivity if the leadership is motivated enough to leave a positive impact. But considering the present scenario when physical classrooms are out of question and students are studying everything online, it brings in a lot of other challenges that we are struggling with. And one of the challenges that we are struggling with is the overflow of the information and content that we have around us. And the another challenge is the constant outflow of fake information. Now, in such scenarios, how do you feel we should be addressing mental growth issues in the school? Don't you feel that this will be one of the biggest challenges that we will have to face in the times to come?
Yeah, that's a great question. So let me unpack that a little bit and talk about a couple things. I think, you know, and again, I'm going to give you an American perspective and the perspective of an American principal, school director. Equity, access, differentiation of curriculum, and the social emotional learning needs are the top priorities for schools. And I would put social and emotional learning at the top. So schools in America, and I'll speak to my school, are making sure that we are working with counselors within our building to provide opportunities for kids to get the support that they need. Now, we are in a virtual environment, so that means that meeting with a school counselor happens virtually. Our learning management platform is Google, so we use Google Meet. You know, of course, other schools use different video platforms, but we want to make sure that we're providing one-on-one opportunities for students to connect with counselors. But we're also working as a staff to create lessons that are available for all kids in the building that focus on social-emotional learning, because I think you would agree with this, it cannot be on the shoulders of one or two people. This is important, and it needs to be something that that educational leaders help an entire staff embrace and make sure that they're working in concert and in unison to meet the needs of students. Now, I will share a couple things, because I think the first part of your question, talking a little bit about social media, it is, you know, and remains a challenge in schools with students who have very quick access. They carry their phones with them all the time. It's very hard to get youngsters to put their phones away. So not only do we deal with, the disinformation piece, which you alluded to, but also with kids that are 11, 12, and 13 years old, sometimes it has to do with texting and sending messages to a friend that may not be kind, and then trying to manage that within the building, or if it happens outside of the building, manage it when it comes into the building. I think one of the things that I encourage schools to take a really good look at is digital citizenship and helping students understand their digital footprint, and also helping kids apply the inquiry skills that we teach within our curriculum to make them really good and smart consumers of information. Because disinformation increases if people are not able to apply a critical mindset to have a better understanding of that information. So I think it's very important for schools to really help kids to be critical thinkers, to help kids analyze information, to understand how media can influence in a positive way or in a negative way, and learn how to make decisions that are informed and hopefully wise.
You know, other than addressing the mental growth issues, we should also focus on nurturing the growth mindset, especially in times like these when we judge students with their grades and most of the times their entire life, the university they'll go to, the career they'll pursue, depends solely on the grades. Don't you feel that the present grading system is a roadblock in nurturing the growth mindset?
Yeah, I think I would agree with that. I think that the schooling that I grew up with, and where I give the example of the very traditional school where I would sit in rows and hear a lecture and take a test every Friday, that school also had a very traditional grading system where you basically took your notes during the week, you took your test on Friday, and you got what you got. Some kids got A's and some kids got F's, and a lot of kids got in between. Now, that is counter to a growth mindset, because a growth mindset would would stem from a belief that if you work hard and get support and apply effort, that you can improve in something. So if one believes in that, we need to find ways within the grading system to allow kids to improve and also to allow kids to take risk. Because one of the things that I've seen is sometimes our most academically able kids are the least inclined to take risks because they're afraid they're going to get a bad grade. So their motivation is to find the easiest way possible to get the best grade possible. Because our society, to some and varying degrees, have made grades the sift, you know, for moving into particular pathways. So, right, so to get into a very good college, you obviously need very good grades. Now, one of the things that I like to see with a growth mindset is flexible grading, where kids have an opportunity to better themselves. That may mean an opportunity to retake something and get a better grade if they understand it better in the future, and an opportunity to demonstrate their learning in different ways. Now, that's, I think, very important, and I think that it is to some degree profound, because I believe that the grade should represent a student's understanding of particular competencies and skills. If they did not know something at the beginning of a unit, but know it at the end of the unit, and we average grades, then their prior transgression, meaning the grade that they received at the beginning of the unit when they were not very competent in the information, counts against them, even though they have mastery of the information at the end of the unit. And if they have mastery of the information at the end of the unit, but their prior transgression is counted against them, then the grade doesn't accurately predict what they know. So we need to be flexible. We need to encourage people to be flexible. Now, one of the things that I will say, and I'll speak particularly about people that I've worked with in the United States, is I don't think that universities train young people particularly well with best practice and research regarding grading. I think I see a lot of young teachers who come out of school and they grade the way that they were graded when they were in school, or they grade the way that a particular teacher that they recall when they were in school did, but often it is not founded in research at all. And many times it can sort and select kids, and at the worst, it can be punitive to kids and be a real negative. Because, you know, as I said earlier, failure does not create motivation. It typically makes kids want to tune out. So we need to find opportunities where kids can have chances to better themselves and to demonstrate their learning at different times, because we all don't learn at the same rate, and to make sure that the grades or the learning that we communicate is an accurate representation of what students know. All of this has to do with mindset, and I'll take it right back to the principle of the building, and I will say that if you want growth mindset, if you want flexible grade books, if you want flexible types of learning, if you want different types of classrooms, all of that has to do with the tonality that the leader sets. You cannot have growth mindset in a building collectively if the principal models or speaks of a fixed mindset. Doesn't work. You may have growth mindset in pockets, but if you really want to have it all across the building, you know, the principal has to believe in that, and they need to support that, and they need to communicate that and demonstrate that with their actions. In turn, encourage teachers to bring that into their classrooms, which in turn encourages kids to start thinking that way. So I always kind of go back to this parallelism that needs to occur from the top of the organization, and in the case of a school, from the principal to the students.
Now that when we are talking about growth mindset, there is one more thing that I would like to understand from you, is the way our economy and the entire paradigm shift which is happening in the world. This changing economic condition are opening doors for various unknown and unseen career opportunities. Now, when we know that we are preparing our pupils for the unknown future, then as educators, what should we do today to make sure that our pupils have complete control of their lives? And secondly, when they are venturing into something unknown, then they will thrive in it.
Well, that's, again, a very good question. The world is changing, and you know, there are students that we are working with right now. Many of them will move into jobs that have not even been created yet. But what I would say is the best way for schools to get kids ready for that are to focus on the skills that kids need to be effective within higher education and also the workforce. Now, you know that, you know, I'll go back to my example. My example when I was in school is I learned the skill of compliance and I learned the skill of memorization. Those are not the skills that companies are looking for or that kids will need to prepare for careers that don't even exist right now. But I can say that some of the workforce skills, you know, and if you read articles on that, that many schools are teaching kids now will get kids ready for that. Things such as creative thinking, creativity, collaboration, communication, problem solving, how to work effectively in teams, inquiry. So I think the more that we focus on making sure that we are inculcating our curriculum with skills that will get kids ready for whatever the future may be, we're in the best position. But I think schools go wrong if they hold on to traditions that teach kids or reward kids for skills that are not necessarily going to be valuable as kids move into the future. So if the school rewards students for being very compliant, or if the school rewards kids for excellent memorization of material, and I'm not saying that memorization is not important, it absolutely has a place, but if it's the primary driver of a classroom, I would say that that's probably out of sync with the larger menu of skills that we need to help our students have.
You know, I believe that one of the skills that we should have is global citizenship. Don't you feel that this is one important skill that we as educators should learn first before imparting this skill to our pupil?
Absolutely. I think, you know, at my core, I think that it is, I'm certainly into helping kids understand the role of diversity. I really like to help communicate the power of unity through diversity. And that comes through increasing understanding and learning. Now, one of the problems, you know, and now it's interesting because the social media does, the internet opens up kids to a much broader world than I saw 20 years ago in schools. But you know, I still am at times in communities where kids will grow up and they'll live their whole lives and never be more than 20 or 30 miles away from where they were born. So their scope can be rather small. I think that it is incumbent on schools to make sure that embedded in the curriculum are numerous opportunities for kids to gain a global perspective and understanding of the world. And that can be done through many different ways. It can be done through multiple subjects, science, history, the literature selections that kids read in a English and a language arts class. So I think that it is important. In fact, I think that it's so important that it needs to be a purposeful guiding focus within a school versus something that just kind of occurs because a particular teacher likes that and wants to integrate that into their curriculum. So I would agree with you 100%.
Well, I believe that one of the best ways to impart global citizenship skills to our students is to open the doors for them and allow them to communicate with people across the world. And to do that, we as educational institutions must collaborate and allow our students to communicate with each other and understand the diversity and inclusion.
Yeah, I think that's incredibly powerful. You know, I know that, you know, in my school, but I've seen in other schools, you know, global citizenship is something that we focus on, and we have had opportunities for classes, our seventh grade classes, which is students who are about 12 years old, in America, to connect with classrooms in Africa, to connect with classrooms in India or in Australia, to learn, you know, and to be able to share with each other, and also to be able to expand the minds of students and have them gain that global perspective, which, and that's the, that is a really positive thing of something like Skype and being able to connect that way. Because, you know, it's one thing to read about it. If you're in America, it's one thing to read about a school in India. But it's a whole other level to be able to read about a school in India and be able to possibly connect with a school where kids can exchange writing and learn to know each other that way. And then connect through Skype or some other video mechanism such as Skype, where they can see each other and they can talk to each other. It is very powerful, and it's one of the very positive things about the world that we live in. What I would say is that we need to approach that with some intentionality and make sure that that's, that, that, that is occurring in schools, because the global perspective is has always been important, more important now than ever. We want to make sure that we are intentionally building those kind of collaborations across the world.
You know, when we talk about diversity and inclusion, I have always seen diversity and inclusion within the countries. Don't you feel that in a world with such diversity, the educational institution should also focus on domestic collaborations other than international collaborations?
Yeah, I think absolutely. I think that that's a very interesting question. So sometimes schools in America can be a little competitive, and so the desire to locally collaborate may not be high, because there's a feeling of competing against each other, and that.
Evan, trust me, the situation is same all across, and schools always feel a sense of competitiveness instead of a sense of collaboration.
Yeah, I think that's interesting, because I appreciate you sharing that, because I did not know that. I just thought that was something that I experienced. I think it's disappointing. I think that my mindset is always that everyone is going to be better than anyone, and that. That as much as I would believe in collaborating globally, I certainly believe in collaborating locally. And there are lots of ways to do it locally, you know, very similar to globally. But I would say that, you know, locally, one of the collaborations that I'd like to see occur more locally is professional collaboration between teachers. You know, when a school division brings in particular professional development, there is an opportunity to invite people from neighboring school divisions or school districts to come and learn together. You know, I don't think that hoarding that kind of information or hoarding those opportunities has any benefit at all. And so I think that's an example of how adults could potentially model collaboration in a more productive way and potentially open up the doors for that to occur more locally. But, you know, as you point out, global collaboration is incredibly important, but equally so is local. And it would be disappointing for a school division to be incredibly connected globally, but having very, very little connections locally. I think the goal would be to have both.
You know, I was talking to one of my previous guests, and he mentioned something that kind of hit me hard. He said that education should be one industry that should be ahead of all other industries. On the contrary, this is the industry which is following other industries. What do you have to say about this?
Education should be a leader amongst many, many industries. But unfortunately, I have not seen that be the case always. You know, I'll give you a very simple example. The rate of change in education has, certainly from what I have seen, has been rather slow. Certainly compared to some of the rate of change within industry. I know you have some a business background. One of the examples that I like to have people think about is if you do a search on your computer of what a classroom looked like 100 years ago, in many cases, it will not look that much different than a classroom today. Now, of course, the picture is going to be in black and white, and there won't be computers in the picture from 100 years ago. But you will often see students sitting in rows, like the example that I gave at the beginning of this podcast. You'll see the teacher at the front of the room, a very traditional setting. If you look at the picture of a business industry from 100 years ago, and you look at the way that business looks today, it is significantly different. And so then it really kind of gets us and should get us asking the question of why. You know, why has business changed so rapidly? And in many cases, education has not. I think that education is changing more rapidly over the last 10 or 15 years, but it still needs to change quicker. I would say that within the world of industry, industry is driven by motivators to be innovative, motivators to be creative, and often the motivator is money. It's the need to be competitive, because if business cannot be competitive and stay ahead of the market or make projections about what's around the corner, sometimes businesses go out of business. But education, in many cases, holds on to things that people hold near and dear from their past. That can be the way that a classroom is set up. That can be the way that a teacher teaches. I guess the quick example would be someone who loves to lecture, and they've always done it, and because it was good enough for them, so it's got to be good enough for kids now. It can be the grading practices that we hold on to, because that's what we experienced in school, and it was good enough for us, so it's good enough for kids. But businesses can't operate that way. A business can't operate and say, well, the way that we did it 20 years ago was good enough back then. It's got to be good enough now. When that occurs in businesses, they go out of business.
You know, I can actually relate the role of a teacher in bringing this desired shift in the education industry. And a teacher who loves the role can actually change the fate of the industry. And I also kind of related with your theory of putting teachers in three different categories and the way students remember them throughout their lives.
Yes, you're talking. I appreciate you taking a look at that video. I think that it's important for educators to reflect a little bit on the broader impact of their job over time. Sometimes, you know, we can get caught up in the moment, and you know, a teacher can be frustrated because a youngster's misbehaving, or they didn't bring the homework, they don't have a pencil, and I'm not discounting those things, but I think it's also important to reflect on how you as an educator will be remembered by students over time. And what I would say, I would certainly say this to you or anyone who's listening to this, that if you think back to an educator that had a very positive influence on you when you were a child, you probably don't recall a lot of the specifics about what that person taught you. I've never asked that question and someone said, well, you know, this teacher had such a profound impact on me because, you know, he made me memorize a poem and stand in front of the class and recite the poem. And if I missed a word, I would get 5 points off. So I was motivated to really do a good job on my recitation of poetry. No one ever says that. What people say is, you know, I recall this teacher when I was 10, 11, or 12 years old who believed in me, who thought I could be something that I couldn't see myself being, who saw leadership in me when I didn't see leadership in myself, who saw my potential when no one else saw my potential. And those are the things that have a significant impact. So I always encourage people to not get too caught up in the moment and make sure that they're allowing themselves to understand the larger impact of what they do. Because the opposite is true too. Someone who is mean, hurtful, sarcastic, intimidating, a yeller, kids don't forget that either. And I would always tell anyone, do you want to be that person? You want to be the person when a family's sitting around a dinner and it's 20, 30 years after you were in school and you still remember that teacher because they were mean? I hope no one wants to be that person, but I think we have to really give some thought to that. I appreciate your question.
And you know what, I feel that why teachers are on the meaner side is because their focus is not on empowering the kids, but on completing the syllabus.
Yes, if your motivation is compliance and to make people do, then being mean and hurtful is typically a way that people try to do that. It's the exact same thing for someone in a leadership position too. What I would say is effective businesses and effective schools will always have a leader who tries to build commitment to something greater with his staff, his or her staff, and the students. But anyone who leads trying to mandate compliance will never get commitment from people, meaning that you can't mandate commitment. You can mandate compliance. But that'll never make enough. No organization, whether it's a business or a school, will ever be effective if it's led by someone who mandates compliance. So positional authority will allow someone to, you know, you can make someone do something if you're into positional authority. And sometimes people will do it because they're beholden. And I'll give you a very simple example. If someone is a very autocratic kind of leader within an organization, and they want to go around and they want to lead with fear, intimidation, threatening staffs, some staff will do it, and unfortunately they'll do it because they need their money. You know, they have responsibilities. They have a family. They have a home. They have a car. They can't just walk away from it, so they have to take it, and that's horrible. But that person will never be committed to the leader, ever. So the same parallel, of course, occurs within a classroom. A teacher who uses punishment as a motivator or to make kids afraid, a teacher who uses failure to think that they can motivate kids, sarcasm, intimidation, yelling, kids might comply, but they're never going to be excited about the teacher, ever. And shame on anyone in a leadership position who allows that to occur in their school, because it's not right for kids.
I completely agree with you, and I couldn't agree more on this. And with this, it's time to say goodbye to you, Evan. Thank you so much for taking our time for this meaningful conversation.
I thank you very much. I enjoyed the conversation.
I hope that you all have enjoyed listening to this conversation with Evan Robb. If you have liked this conversation, then do rate us on Apple Podcasts and share it in your network. And we will meet again in the next episode with another amazing guest. Thank you for listening to The Ed Show. You can now listen to the same podcast on Apple and Google Podcasts, or you can watch it live on YouTube. And I'll see you in the next episode. Till then, stay safe and stay happy.